Good afternoon. Today I'll be discussing sexual initiation, parenting practices, and acculturation in Hispanic seventh graders. I have no relationships to disclose. To give a little background, data from the Middle School Youth Risk Behavior Survey show that 34% of Hispanic middle school students have ever had sex. Among sexually active Hispanic students, 5.2 reported their first sexual encounter before age 11, and 9.4 have reported having multiple partners. Early sexual activities associated with contracting STIs, increased number of sexual partners, and also an increased risk of teen pregnancy. Among Hispanic youth, they also have the second highest rates of STIs, such as chlamydia and gonorrhea, and they also have the highest pregnancy rate compared to other ethnic groups. 13% of HIV diagnoses are also among Hispanic teens ages 13 to 19. These are just some of the factors that influence early sexual initiation. Parent-child communication and parental monitoring are known as parenting processes, and we also have acculturation. The literature shows that studies of Hispanic populations, that parental-child communication about sexual behavior is associated with lower rates of sexual activity, less risky behavior, and lower odds of teen pregnancy, but few studies have focused on middle schoolers. Studies also show a relationship between high levels of parental monitoring and reduced sexual risk-taking behavior or delayed sexual initiation among youth, but the majority of studies also do not focus on Hispanic middle schoolers. Studies also have examined the association between acculturation and Hispanic youth sexual activities, but the studies have yielded very mixed results because they've used different acculturation measures. So the purpose of this study is to examine the effect of parental monitoring and parent-child communication on ever having had sex among Hispanic seventh graders while controlling for acculturation and other recognized covariates. A better understanding of this association is needed because of the possible protective effects of these parenting practices. Our data came from a larger study, which included students from 15 urban middle schools in Southeast Texas. They were participants in a randomized controlled trial to evaluate two youth sexual education interventions. 78% of the students were classified as economically disadvantaged. The data that we used were from baseline from October of 06 to February of 07, and then first follow-up from March 07 to June of 07. Our sub-study used data from Hispanic 7th graders across all intervention arms who completed both baseline and first follow-up. Students missing any data on the dependent variable, or covariates were removed, leaving us with the final sample of 655 for analysis. We used data from two time points because some demographics were only collected at baseline. So our participants were primarily of Mexican origin, female, and had a mean age of 13. The majority of students were born in the U.S. and were second generation. Almost equal percentages of students were classified into the bicultural, low, and high acculturation levels. Most students reported living with both biological parents and having a parent or guardian who did not finish high school. These are the variables that we use for our analysis. The dependent variable was ever had sex. Students answered yes or no in response to have you ever had vaginal sex. The independent variables were parental monitoring and parent-child communication. Parental monitoring we used a five-item scale with questions such as how much do your parents really know about who your friends are? Response options were don't know, know a little, know a moderate amount, and know a lot. Parent-child communication was a seven-item scale with questions such as how many times has your parent ever talked to you about waiting to have sex? Response options included we've never talked about it, we've talked about it once or twice, and we've talked about it many times. Acculturation was measured using a 12-item linguistic proficiency subscale of the bidimensional acculturation scale for Hispanics by Marin and Gamba. And those are the other covariates that we also included in the model. So using one-way ANOVAs and chi-score analysis, we tested for differences among acculturation groups for the independent variable, dependent variable, and covariates individually. To assess the association between independent variables and ever had sex, we calculated bivariate prevalence odds ratios and 95% confidence intervals. Then using a 10% change between unadjusted and adjusted odds ratios and the log likelihood test, we identified confounders. If it was unclear whether a variable was a confounder, we used the literature to decide. The multivariate logistic regression model included the independent variables and the confounders identified. We entered all the variables at one time into the model, and then we removed them using the log likelihood test. The final model included both confounders contributing significantly to the model and pertinent variables from the literature. This slide shows our bivariate analysis between the independent variables and ever had sex. The findings show there was a significant association between parental monitoring and ever had sex. The odds of ever having had sex decreased by 48% for every 1-point increase in the parental monitoring score, and there was no significant association between ever having had sex and parent-child communication. The covariates that we included in the final model were age, gender, parent-guardian education, family structure, acculturation, and intervention status. After adjusting for the covariates, the odds of ever having had sex decreased significantly by 50% for every 1-point increase in the parental monitoring score. Females were also 76% less likely to report ever having had sex compared to males. The odds of ever having had sex increased twofold with every 1-year increase in age. There was no association between ever having had sex and parental communication. And the goodness of fit test conducted on the final model was also non-significant. Okay, so basically we found from our results that with increasing levels in parental monitoring, there was a decreased odds of ever having sex among seventh graders. We believe that this was related to safety from threats. Most of the middle schoolers came from low-income neighborhoods, so we know that parents in these neighborhoods have to deal with environmental factors, safety such as maybe gang violence, or crime in the area, so it could be related to this. Also, we didn't find any association between ever having had sex and parent-child communication, and we believe this could be related to reluctance or embarrassment on the parents' part to speak with their child on these sexual topics, and it also could be related because the parents may not have knowledge about these topics, or they might have a decreased education level. I believe 60% of the parents in this sample didn't finish high school, so that could also be related. And we didn't find an association between ever had sex and acculturation, and this could be attributed to the measures that we used. So future directions. Researchers need to determine the temporal sequence of the variables by conducting longitudinal studies on Hispanic middle schoolers. Another important finding that we observed in parental monitoring by acculturation group, our sample size was too small, so we couldn't explore this further, but the finding was also not related to the results of parental monitoring and ever having had vaginal sex in the multivariable model, but we recommend that researchers investigate how the association between parental monitoring and ever having had sex differed between the different acculturation groups. Our results also can inform the development or enhancement of school-based interventions designed to delay sexual initiation for Hispanic youth and their parents. As we saw from our findings, parents may need help to develop their skills to, in order to facilitate communication about sexual topics with their children and possibly increase their knowledge about them. We recommend incorporating a skills-building component to help parents communicate with their children. This would help parents to, one, become more comfortable in approaching their child and discussing the topic, and would also give them the possibly the knowledge, the information that they're lacking to add breadth or depth to the content of the discussions with their children. Schools could also deliver the curriculum to parents either through parent educators that are already working in the school districts or using community health workers that we also know as promotoras, or even using, there was one study out there that I found that used a computer-based intervention for this. So just quickly, some limitations of this study. Of course, we only get a snapshot of Hispanic seventh graders at one point in time, so we can't determine whether the independent variables caused or preceded the outcome. We also have selection bias, given that our researchers only administered the survey to English-speaking students, and in order to participate in the study, children had to have parental consent from their parents. Information bias could also have resulted from the self-report. For example, boys could have over-reported having sex, whereas girls could have under-reported it. And children also who are more closely monitored by their parents could have been inclined to under-report sex. We also only measured it using the student self-report of their parents' behavior, so we didn't actually measure the parents' actual behavior. And additionally, we measured acculturation using a linguistic scale, and we know that acculturation is a more complex subject, so it would need to be measured using other items for like cultural traditions, social relationships, etc. And the last, we just want to acknowledge our study participants and our funding. Thank you very much. If anyone has any questions. Okay. What I did before choosing the scale, we did a literature review of all the acculturation scales. And be it that we were limited on the size of the scale we could include, this one has 12 items. So the larger ones that include more dimensions can be up to like 20 or 60 questions. So we were limited on that for size. And also we chose it because it classifies children, anybody, as low, high, or bicultural. Like it doesn't measure them unidimensionally. It can measure both, so they can come out like being in the middle, bicultural. So that was another reason. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions, which can be directed to any of the speakers. Okay, well, I have, yes.
I don't have a question. I'm happy to be here, but I would like anybody in the audience and the panelists to give my card, because I've been working on something which is like all the negative implications of prescribing virginity as a protection to young women, including the reinforcement of gender inequity, more anal sex, all sorts of things. So it's like negative program implications of prescribing virginity globally, you know, whether it's South Africa or the United States. So anybody who's interested in that topic, if I could get your card.
And it's not the floor speaking, it's something that you probably can't see. I have a question I'll ask mine last after.
It's a sort of a common theme of all of your presentations about parents not really having the ability, regardless of what culture, because I don't know what culture is comfortable talking about sex. Is there programs or models that have been able to successfully help parents?
my personal experience, there are programs around the world where parents have been engaged on sexual issues, but there's very little in terms of reporting. I mean, very few studies have been published. In the UK, the Family Planning Association has a program called Speakeasy, and that's the FPA actually engage with the parents on a program that will probably last over 8 to 12 weeks. But due to funding, it's only been practiced in a few parts of the country. But you know, anecdotal feedback is that it is empowering. It does work, but I just sense that we have a lack of reporting on this issue. Certainly in our work, in our research, parents want to have that dialogue. The kids themselves want to have that dialogue. We had one piece of research where we asked, what is your main source of sex education? So inevitably, peers, friends, internet, parents came out eighth. But when we asked which source is the most credible, parents was number one. And when we probed, youngsters are saying, yes, we want to have that dialogue. But parents feel they don't have the tools, they don't have the right materials upon which to engage with our children. So from my experience, yeah, there's still a long, long way to go to providing a solution for parents.
And there are programs all around that work with parents, but traditionally parents are one of the most difficult groups to get to enter into these kinds of programs, and very often, you know, if you're talking to them about, how do you keep your kids safe? That's a way to enter, get parents involved. But if you want to help, how do you talk to your kids to have them more sexually healthy? It's much more difficult to bring parents in to those conversations, and so recruitment has always been an issue. I know CECAS has a big program. Families are talking. Planned Parenthood had a big program on working with parents and families, and those small groups, when they are actually able to work with it, they find that they're successful. It's really hard to replicate and to bring parents in.
I think also what's important is just the message that talking to your kids about sex doesn't mean you have to be an expert on sex, doesn't mean, it means that open communication, and the idea that kids want to hear from you even if you don't think they're listening is one that parents don't recognize that. So, you know, our young people talked extensively about wishing that they could talk more with their parents, about actually wanting to, about being afraid to talk about it because then their parents would think they were having sex or would be angry at them. And so sometimes it's not just the nuts and bolts to say to parents, you should tell your child this, but just letting parents know what the importance is of that communication, and defining communication not just as tell your kid not to have sex or tell your kid use condoms, because the message is not really communication. So when we ask, for example, in your study you said you defined parent-child communication as, you know, how many times has your parent talked to you about waiting to have sex, which is one of many, many things that parents can communicate. And so unfortunately, I don't think we have a lot of really good measures of what is good parent-child communication about sex. And so we measure it with, you know, one item or one or two items that are around the particular message. You know, have your parents told you not to have sex? Have your parents told you about condoms? Rather than about what is good parent-child communication overall.
That is actually exactly my question. I kind of like surprised or astonished how little intimacy was prevalent at all, that the parents talked about. I was wondering whether it's perhaps something that we don't measure enough, how much, or whether, that's my question to you, whether it's because, or one question, whether it's maybe a measurement artifact that one doesn't kind of find that the parents talk even about relationships or healthy relationships. Or whether one should perhaps, rather than sort of say that parents should start talking to their kids about sex, perhaps they should talk to their kids about healthy relationships and what does it mean as they grow up to have a boyfriend-girlfriend period with mm-hmm. or without sex. And
This is not groundbreaking. I mean, this has been found over and over again.
Quite an interesting example. Our youngest son just entered UC Merced, and so he's just a freshman. So after 2 months, he gets this newsletter. All students get it, and it's about well-being, healthy nutrition, take care of yourself, financial. And it had this whole article about comparing casual sex with sex, having sex in a long-term relationship and pros and cons and kind of things. So of course we being decent, so he sent it to me and had yet again another discussion about this topic. But at the very least, it all freshmen got this, which kind of would be kind of late for but this would be something very easy as well that one could do to freshmen in high school, mm-hmm. kind of talking. And not only about sex, but about this is casual sex, this is in a relationship, this is within a healthy relationship, or something like that. So.
Yeah.
Question over here.
Well, I wanted to point out, I think it's worth noting that in the research on parents' influence, there are other factors aside from parent-child communication that we heard about parental monitoring being an important influence, and also parent-child connectedness and just the quality of their relationship and having a close relationship with their kids has a huge influence. And I think that all three of those things can be interconnected. And so if the connectedness, if the quality of the relationship is not there, the messages that the parents are sending may fall flat. They can talk all they want, but if they don't have a close, trusting relationship with their children, then the messages aren't going to get through the same way. So we need to be addressing those three. Right.
Behind her.
So one other thing you may want to think about adding to your implications is you talked a lot about the expectations both young women and men had around their first sexual experiences. And it seems to me, you know, we focus in the education field on normative education around, you know, what's normal, what's actually happening among young people in terms of sex abuse, in terms of age before sex. And that we need to do a better job of doing normative education around what first sexual experiences actually are like. The most normal, healthy, behavioral aspects of development, the first time people have sex is not going to be optimal for them, right? So you want
no butterflies and rainbows.
Sensual and pleasurable and, you know, as ideal as possible, but at the same time, I think just shifting norms and perceptions around, you know, making those perceptions and norms more realistic is important. And that's going to be, no matter when people have their first sexual encounter, whether they're young adults or adolescents, that information is going to be helpful.
Well, and you know what's so interesting is that there's so many other messages out there. If you look in the media, for example, I don't want to keep, you know, villainizing the media, but, you know, that say that your first sexual experience is the most amazing thing. You know, so they're getting, and then the responsible messages that should be coming from the home, that should be coming from schools, that should be coming from health professionals, are silent on that issue. And so the only messages that they're getting about it are these, like, oh my God, the fireworks and the explosion, that, and no one's having realistic conversations about, not that it can't be wonderful, but that here are some more realistic, and here's what can happen. And so the silence around these conversations around relationships and the more intricate kinds of contextual factors that go on leave this big vacuum that gets filled by, you know, the society.
And there was a question over here, and then we have time for one.
The panel, the $1 million question. If I have $1 million, what should I do? On HIV/AIDS, we focused a lot on peer education, you know, friends with friends. They talk a lot about sex. But what we see in a lot of research houses is that they don't respect that talk. But peer education has been a focus. So what is the alternative? If I have $1 million,
only $1 million.
What should I do?
Okay. Not peer education. Did you
peer
education?
P-E-E.
Oh.
Like engaging young men to speak to their friends about sex, about their first sex experience, other than, you know, focusing more on parents, because we know that people are much more exposed to friends when they really...
But how accurate is that information, that knowledge going to be? There's a lot of bravado in schools. We heard it earlier about, you know, the myth. Everyone's doing it from a very early age. Peer promotion as well, does it work? Doesn't it? In Eastern Europe, related to this study that I presented, peers and the NGO sector were crucial because the formal sector, schools, as far as sex education is concerned, was just non-existent. And luckily there are some good examples of peer-led programs in Eastern Europe. And without those, then the situation would be even worse in terms of high incidence of STIs and HIV, etc.
And a lot of the peer education that takes place, though, takes place in the context of schools. So, you know, they'll train a set of peer educators who come into the class and do the condom demonstration, or, you know, do the showing the disgusting pictures. So there's this sense that, well, we're still doing the same education, but we're having peers do it, so therefore it's going to be more effective. I'm not convinced that it necessarily is. Our young people talked about a wide variety of things where they heard these messages at school, but it was the message that they remembered, the banana, the gross pictures, all of those things, and they clearly were not effective. So, I mean, I think that it's not so much about who's delivering the message. I mean, the importance of who's delivering the message has to do with respect and relationship between the person delivering the message or the person hearing the message. But the message itself is really, I think, where we've fallen short, because we're so caught up in messages around HIV and STDs and disgusting disease genitalia and pregnancy and abortion. We're so caught up in what the message is rather, and that message is not very effective. So I actually think we have to be thinking about both sides, not just the message deliverer, but the message itself. Because clearly, especially here in the United States, the message that sex is a pleasurable thing that's part of a normal, healthy relationship, preferably monogamous, whether in or outside of marriage, but preferably a healthy, normal relationship with a single other person, is not a message that our kids are getting. Mm-hmm. It's not a message that most schools are providing. It's not a message that most parents are providing. So I think the problem may be the message itself, which gets to your issue about what is realistic to expect the first time you have sex. Are you going to have fireworks? Chances are not. But that's all part of that general thing about what is sex and what's its role in health, what's its role in life, what's its role in a relationship.
If I only had $1 million, I'd put it into teacher training.
We've now hit. I'd put it into good parenting.
Well, if anybody has those kinds of millions, I say, let any of us know. By my clock watch, it's 2 o'clock. I don't know that these folks are rushing off somewhere. If they're not and you have a question, I'm sure they're more than willing to at least try to answer those questions. Thank you very much.